You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking to Nicole Owai. She's calling me from Brooklyn. Nicole, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Nicole, let's talk about what you're making right now. What's happening in your studio?
Right now, I am finishing up, actually as we're speaking, works for my show that opens next week at Leslie Heller Workspace. I call the show Vistas. So I'm working on pieces that I think are paintings that are coincidentally sculptures as well for that show.
So let's talk about that. Leslie Heller, is that the gallery that represents you, or is this your first show there?
It's my first show there.
And so let's talk about what you're making. How are they paintings and coincidentally sculptures?
Well, I guess I think of myself as, I guess I'm a multimedia artist, but I don't shy away from being called a painter. I think of myself as that because I come from painting and painting language and painting tradition. And these are relief works that sort of sit on the wall, but, you know, for me, come from sort of painting gesture and painting considerations.
So that's interesting. Let's talk about how you're building these relief works. How are you molding or modeling them or building those?
They are works on synthetic paper, and I'm sort of painting onto them with resin and acrylic paint and nail polish, which has been part of my practice conceptually and as a material for the last 17 years as well. I add in other relief elements that might be made out of paper as well, or other foreign materials.
So when you say synthetic paper, what does that mean exactly? It's not made out of pulp from trees. What is synthetic paper?
No, these synthetic paper has been around for a bit now, and a lot of us have been using it. It's sort of plastic. I think the main brand is Yupo.
Sorry to interrupt, but is that kind of like Tyvek too? That was.
I guess in a sense they are. They probably are all related. Sort of just probably chemically or materially different ratios, you know. But yeah, these are all things that sort of equate paper properties that hold drawing materials and painting materials very well, similar to the way that paper would.
And when you're making these in relief, what does that mean? These aren't being stretched, or are they wrapped around other objects?
When I say relief, they're sort of built upon with the material, with the resin, or with other, you know, materials stuck onto it, or with the paper being bent or folded in certain ways so that they project off the wall a bit.
And are they attached to the wall, or are these all coming off affixed to a board? Are you working on board itself?
No. It's just attached to the wall.
And so let's talk about your use of because I know about that, your use of nail polish going back almost two decades. What started your use of nail polish as among many other things in your work, and why has it stayed so consistent?
It initially showed up in little series of paintings that I did back around, I think around 2000 or 2001, called Identifying Desire. And in those paintings, I put in what I call the sensation code. And originally, the very first sensation code also had women's foundation in it too, you know, makeup. As well as the nail polish, the makeup was just so unstable and I couldn't fix it. But the nail polish remained. And I think in that moment, I was looking at sort of the way that women codify themselves and sort of those systems. And as myself as an individual, particularly for me, the nail polish since I was a teenager, you know, the way that it's something that sort of became part of the representation of me, you know. So I realized in that moment that I actually had some nail polish that I had since I was 15 years old, and saw the patterns of, like, you know, when I wore certain colors, etc., to sort of represent myself or present myself in a certain way. And particularly for women of color, I think initially when I was looking at the foundation, how difficult it was, especially back, I mean, probably not now, but back in the 90s, you know, for a person with my heritage, I'm Afro-Asian from the Caribbean, to find, you know, the correct makeup shades, very difficult, you know. What was being offered did not sort of consider the multiplicity of the Americas as a woman of color.
It's so true, and kind of incredible to hear that, you know, how recent all that is. I think even if I'm not mistaken, the crayon in the box of Crayolas, that was, I think, for quite a long time, the color was just called flesh color or something, a kind of a pink, within there remarkably long. I mean, that seems to be kind of such a sort of odd oversight of...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. That's really interesting. So in a way, your use of nail polish and initially makeup was also about identity and being a woman of color and what that meant to grapple with on a visual basis, in a sense, right?
Yeah, it did. You know, I've always done this work with multiple layers of meaning. I mean, you know, I'm not the one who's interested in just giving you black bodies, etc. I'm often giving you information through different layers, levels, and I'm also sort of challenging how people take information in. You know, we tend to respond to what we think is familiar, like familiar languages and canons. And, you know, in those works in particular, my early drawing works and some of my early painting works, I was really looking at that and trying to create sort of visual systems that would sort of lead people to sort of draw them in, but then draw them into something that actually is not familiar. And the nail polish became interesting, even more interesting as it went along, because I started to really pay attention to sort of the naming of the nail polish. And over using it for almost 2 decades now, as you're quite right, I've sort of been able to kind of map sort of the trajectory of how, you know, urban sort of sociological evolution has occurred, you know, and how the space has broadened or at least acknowledges sort of this multiplicity that exists. Nail polish colors are no longer like autumn red, you know. It's, you know, we have these fabulous nail polish colors that really speaks to the space. So I was using colors like I'm not a tourist. Or it's great. Or you know, pinpoint black and blue. You know, they were all these Chelsea art scene. There's all of these, you know, that really speak to that space, you know, and that all of these, you know, bodies and experience make up that space now.
That's fascinating, and of course, not something I'm watching or following as closely as you are. So you're saying, over the past several years, you're paying attention also to all the names, how all the nail polish has changed names, which says something not only about how they're handling all the different people using it, but also almost I don't know how to put it, almost something about feminism itself as how it's evolving. Would that be accurate to say?
I mean, I definitely think so. Of course, these are products that are made, I guess, with women in mind. I mean, you know, but in society now, we can't say that. You know, there's many people across the gender spectrum that, you know, probably use nail polish that we didn't consider before, but, you know, it's speaking to the multiplicity of those voices and those experiences, you know. And, you know, so I started to plug in the names into this sensation code. You know, I plugged in these things which are, you know, which were meant to sort of imply a narrative, but, you know, was in a really a misdirection because it's not really, I'm not really giving you a specific narrative. But, you know, there were these interesting misdirections that actually started to sort of direct me as well, as I made.
That's interesting. So let's talk about that a little bit. Interesting misdirections in terms of the reading or the research you're doing based on some of the changing names that are happening in nail polish?
Well, you know, that was initially, you know, just sort of observationally taking that in initially. But, you know, as I really started to look at it and really started to pay attention, I think some of those names did start to lead. And so, you know, I was doing drawings in my local ephemera series where there was one called, what was it called? It was called Local Ephemera Castle Nut and Drama Queen. And Drama Queen was a nail polish color by L'Oreal. It was called Drama Queen. It's this beautiful fuchsia color that actually, you know, and some of these colors, because they're popular, would get reissued, and I think it was around for quite a while. But, you know, so I included it in the title, and a castle nut is a nail and lock and screw configuration, locking device configuration.
Castle nut.
So locking, you know, so it's a screw with, you know, with a washer locking device. And in the local ephemera series, I was using sort of technical drawing language as well in the format. And so sometimes I would have some of these things that sort of reference, you know, actual technical drawing, drafting, international kind of symbols. So there's an international symbol for a castle nut, how you draw it in sort of in you show it in two elevations kind of thing. So that configuration is also part of the drawing. And in the main part of the drawing, you see something that to me is an abstraction, but, you know, for everybody else takes it as some sort of body figure. It's this double-sided figure that one side is, I guess I use me as the model, and the other side is a transgendered person holding a cat. And so that is Castle Nut Drama Queen. Who's the castle nut?
I love
Who's
that.
Drama Queen?
I love that.
What's
There's
going
so
on?
Many layers to that. It's really wonderful. I like that so much. So in this current show that you're working on, are you using those same kind of elements and techniques and wordplay with titles as well?
Well, not in this. These are sort of Vistas is a series that I started in 2013, and actually three of these works initially showed in a show called American Beauty at Susan Englert Gallery, and I just showed the first three, but they were part of a new body of work that I was sort of looking at what the possible sort of influences on my work was at, you know, as it had evolved, because, you know, there were certain things that were persistent. Yes, the nail polish, but there was this oozing materiality that had substantially established itself as, you know, being black in color. And, you know, I was thinking about those things. So in 2012, I believe, I got an Art Matters grant to sort of look into, you know, what those influences were. And I went to Trinidad, where I am from originally.
Before you go into the story of Trinidad, just to be clear, the Art Matters grant was supporting what specifically? Travel for research?
Well, it was travel for this particularly, for this particular research, looking into the influences on my work, because I had been in discussion about expansive painting practices for a while. And actually in 2013, did a talk at CAA, a panel discussion about expansive painting that was put together by Anna Kunz. And so it was really, all of this was coming together, you know, really thinking about those influences. And so I went to Trinidad to investigate that influence, thinking that maybe in some peripheral way, the pitch lake, the lake of asphaltum that is there in Trinidad, that maybe that may have been an influence, a peripheral influence on me, maybe from my childhood.
Okay, so I wanted to tell you about that. So let's talk about, you go to Trinidad, and I don't know about that particular fault. So tell me a little bit about, what you researched there and about that fault. I don't know about that pitch.
The pitch lake. So this phenomenon of lakes of asphaltum, there are a few in the world. There's some out in California. I think there's one in Russia. There's both, I think, four or five of them. There's this one in Trinidad, which produces the finest grade asphaltum in the world. I thought about that as I was thinking about, where is this place?
But wait, I'm sorry to interrupt. The
materiality.
The lake is black. What's filling the lake is it's a black mineral or something.
Yes, exactly. It's a petroleum byproduct, right? This is basically what it is. That's an occurrence. Yes, that comes to the surface.
And you can swim in it. You can't swim in it,
here's the thing that's funny. I have realized that I had never been there. I had initially thought I'd been there as a child, but I did not. I actually did not go to this site. So if it is an influence, it's probably from my textbooks at school or something. So when I went to Trinidad and I actually visited, I realized it was the first time I had been there. It is an expanse of open expanse of, and it's, how should I put it? You know, it's got grassy in some areas, etc. But then there is, you know, it's kind of like undulating surface that is black in color somewhat, but, you know, also covered in a lot of mud too. And towards the center of this place is where it is softest, and it's that the center is called the mother of the lake. Actually, it's so funny, on the periphery of this space is I think it's called, you know, Trinidad and Tobago Asphalt Limited or something. That's the factory, right? You know, and they're basically, there's these trolleys that are coming down to the lake of asphaltum, and they, you know, they're loading it up and taking it up, from there. It's really an interesting, alien expanse of strange,
right,
interesting place. But it's not, you know, it's not like oozing and bubbling everywhere. It's really more, if it's kind of wet and loose, it's more towards the center, you know, and it dries and it cracks to the surface. If you take the official government tour, which you're supposed to do, that's the way you're supposed to be on there. You're not supposed to be on there any other way. But I did take the unofficial tour with somebody from the village there as well. But, you know, on the official tour, they would tell you, you know, that the trucks gathering the material, you know, could only stay in one position, you know, for 10 minutes, and then they have to move because, you know, it starts to sink. But it's not like this loose thing. So it was interesting. I mean, here's the thing I realized. I mean, I think the language, it was interesting to me because while I was there also, you know, I would go to the archive there at National Library and you know, look up sort of the history of that spot and realize that some of the ways that I was thinking about materiality really matched the language that some of the early geologists used to describe that space. You know, like this sense of inertia, but also this sense of, you know, this sort of slow kind of oozing movement. You know, it was amazing to me that, you know, sort of that their language that described what they were seeing, you know, two centuries ago when they initially came upon this space, just sort of matched the way that I was thinking about materiality. But I don't think that I was making work about that space. I think that space probably might have been in my imagination because it sort of encapsulates, I think, the essence of materiality for me. I mean, when you think of it, all of these spaces, you know, and you know, they're us. They're the byproduct of us. This is millions of years of flora and fauna that, you know, we use, you know, as either to power our cars, to, in the case of the Pitch Lake, to pave our roads, to use, they use this as sealant all over the world, nautical sealant, building sealant, you know, all of this comes from, so this interesting idea that we are not separate from the ground. We are not separate from materiality ourselves. We are part of that. And I think that's the thing that I might be fascinated about, you know, sort of that, that the embodiment of that embodies, you know, time, space, everything, all of us. And I think that's what I'm fascinated with.
I love that. I love that. And, and that sounds like such a fascinating trip back to Trinidad, too, to look at all that. I mean, just kind of not only going home, but also exploring something as kind of wonderful and as odd as that is.
Mm-hmm. It was an odd and interesting experience, I must say.
So it's exciting to hear about your upcoming show. There'll be links to that here, of course, so people can see it. Is there anything else you want to say about this show that's coming up in terms of, we're talking about materials, but is there a content in this one that you haven't used before or that we should discuss?
Well, I mean, I think with the vistas, I was really looking at sort of the second, I'm so fascinated with language, and I'm always, you know, I'm always looking into how language evolves and changes. And the word vista, you know, we have one idea of its main meaning, but I was interested in its secondary meaning. And secondary meaning is a mental view of a succession of remembered or anticipated events. And so the vistas are this idea of these glimpse spaces, these glimpse experiences. You know, I want them to feel like they are not permanent, like, you know, like there might be something that appears shortly and may disappear, that you feel like if you turn your head, you know, and turn back, it either it's changed or it's gone, you know. So I think that's what I'm trying to do with these works. They work together as a body, but they also work together. They work separately as individual pieces. But this is my, you know, first opportunity to sort of see them all together and see how they kind of work in that way as vistas, as those glimpse experiences.
That's exciting. I wish you well with that show, and I'll probably come see it as well. Before we go, I want to ask you the question that I always ask everybody, which is, what are you reading right now? It could be off topic or anything at all, really.
I just finished the semester, and it was a busy semester. So I am catching up on reading, and actually I am going to try to finish read something that actually has to do with me, because I am mentioned and talked about in the book. It's called Creole in the Archive, Imagery, Presence, and the Location of the Caribbean Figure by Roshini Kempadu. And that's what I'm going to try to finish read right now. That among other things, I'm sure, yes. go ahead.
Well, no, you tell me. Was there something else that you were going to mention that you'd also like to read or about to read?
One more thing is, just found out a few days ago, didn't even realize that it had come out, but there's also another essay on my work in the current issue of Small Acts, which is a Caribbean Journal of Criticism that's put out by Duke University. And there's an essay in it by Michelle Stevens about my work called Oozing Between Dimensions, Multiple Perspectives on the Real in the Works of Nicola Y. So that I have to read as well.
Nicola, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.